one of John Vuong's teachings that most struck home with me was his statement one night that the purpose of the practice is to purify the heart. You know, all the other things he said, all the other psychic powers and other things that can attract people to the practice, is those are just games. The real purpose is the purity of the heart. So how do you purify the heart? As the Buddha told his son, you look at your actions as a mirror for your heart. Like we're doing right now with the breath. The breath is like a mirror for the mind. The way we breathe, the way we relate to the breath energy in the body, tells us a lot about the state of the mind right now. It's possible to sit down and within a few minutes give yourself a headache, a backache, get things all messed up inside. Or it's possible to find that there are areas of pleasure that you can develop, potentials that you can develop, that can give rise to a state of ease and well-being. And a lot of it depends on how observant you are. That was another one of John Vuong's most frequent teachings, which is that whatever happens in your meditation, you have to be observant to watch what you're doing, to watch the results. And when something comes up in the mind that seems interesting, you have to immediately watch what the mind does in response. Sometimes something very attractive, something very impressive can come up in your meditation. Immediately you latch onto it and it spoils it. You're not paying attention to the fact of how you're reacting to things. And so you can miss a lot of things that way. Which is why when the Buddha taught Rahula, he taught him to look at his actions throughout the day, his speech throughout the day, his thoughts throughout the day. You want to watch yourself not only while you're meditating, but as you go through the day. See what you're doing, see what you're saying, see what you're thinking, and seeing the impact it has, both on you and on other people. Because the quality of purity goes along with two other qualities, wisdom and compassion. Wisdom is realizing that true happiness is going to have to come from your own efforts. And for true happiness to be true, it has to be long-term. And to be long-term, it can't harm anyone else. This is how wisdom connects with compassion. You want happiness that doesn't harm you, doesn't harm other people. And so you have to keep their well-being in mind. And then the quality of purity comes when you look at your actions, your words, and your thoughts to see how do they fit in with these principles that you've set up as your goal. The principle of a true happiness, a harmless happiness. And you have to be very thorough. It's one of the reasons why the teaching is not just something that's contained in words or can be put in books. The Buddha set up a monastic order. So that people could live closely with their teachers to see how these things, these principles are employed in day-to-day life. And for the teachers to have the ability to see what the student's doing, to see where the student is missing the implications. Because it's easy on the one hand to get an idea of the general principles and then to go off and totally be ignorant of how those principles apply. Especially in your day-to-day dealings with the people around you. So the Dharma is not just words. In fact, the words of the Dharma, the words of a Dharma talk, say, are said to point to the Dharma. Dharma desana, the pointing to the Dharma, that's the term for a Dharma talk, or one of the terms for a Dharma talk. The actual Dharma is something that arises in your mind. It's a quality of the heart that's comprised of wisdom, compassion, and this effort to be pure in your actions, i.e. to make sure that your actions really do fall in line with your principles. Now, because the breath is so intimately related to any kind of action you may do, this is a good place to stay, to watch both the mind and your actions and your words. It's more than both right there. Mind, actions, words, everything, you want to watch them. And the breath is a good place to stay to see this. Without the breath, you couldn't move your mouth, you couldn't move your body. It would be possible for the mind to think without the breath, but it would be this kind of disembodied consciousness. It wouldn't have an impact on the world outside. It's through the breath that you relate to the world around you. First you relate to the other properties of the body, and then through the breath you also relate to other people. It's because of the breath energy in your eye that you see other people, you hear other people, because of the breath energy in the ear. So staying with the breath is a good place to watch all of this and learn to be very observant. And if you see that you're doing something unskillful, try to develop a healthy sense of shame, i.e. realizing that that was something that did not go in line with your principles, and a mistake that you don't want to repeat again. Again, this is why we have teachers, so you can go and talk to them about the mistake. But the teachers don't want to do all the work for you. In fact, that was one of Ajahn Fung's main ways of instruction. If there was something he saw that you were really confused about, he would straighten you out. But there are other times when he'd throw it back to you. You have to observe for yourself, like the way you're breathing right now, the way you're relating to the breath energy right now. Nobody can get into your head. Nobody else can get into your body and straighten things out for you. This is the way it's been with everybody all along. You have to learn how to relate to your own breath and figure out what you're doing that's wrong. And then use your ingenuity. If something's not working, try something new. And this ability to come up with new approaches and then be willing to test them, that's how you develop skill inside. How you relate to your own breath, how you relate to the energies and other potentials in the body right now. This is something each of us has to discover for him or herself. That's why John Fuchs said that as a meditator you have to think like a thief. In other words, you can't expect the teacher to tell everything to you and give you all the solutions. You have to look around yourself and catch the signs, just like a thief planning to rob somebody's house. Can't go up to the front door and knock on it and say, "Hey, when are you going to be away? And by the way, where do you keep your valuables?" You've got to watch, case the joint, hide out behind the bushes until you notice their patterns. That's when you know when you can slip into the house and you get an idea of what's valuable in the house and where it's kept. By being observant. So let's keep this point in mind that ultimately you have to be your own teacher. You have to come up with ideas when you find yourself face to face with a problem and you've tried all the solutions that you've read in the books and they don't seem to work. Well, you go back and think about how you might tweak them. Because all the basic principles are there. It's simply the question of which principle applies to your situation right now. That story I tell about the cornerstone in the ordination hall in Bodhisokarama. John Fuang told that to me one time to explain the attitude of proper respect for your teacher. When he first laid the foundations for the ordination hall, they were anticipating that the Buddha image would be on the west side of the hall facing east, as it is in almost every ordination hall in Thailand, because the Buddha was supposed to have been facing east on the night of his awakening. And so they placed the cornerstone with all the relics and Buddha images and passages of Dharma and other sacred objects under the spot where they thought the Buddha image would be. And John Lee changed his mind as the building was under construction and decided to put the image on the east side facing west. Apparently that was his way of forecasting that Buddhism was going to move west. But when the hall was done, they realized that the cornerstone was now under a section of the hall that people were going to be stepping over. Now in Thailand, there's a great taboo against stepping over objects like that. Someone pointed this out to a John Lee one day, so John Lee turned to a John Fuang and said, "Well, tomorrow I'll get all the monks down there and move it." Now John Fuang knew it could not be moved. It was firmly planted in the ground. But he knew if he said that it couldn't be done, John Lee would say, "Well, I'll find someone else who does have the conviction that it can be done." So the next morning, John Fuang got all the able-bodied monks and novices under the ordination hall, wrapped ropes and around the thing, tried to pull it, used crowbars to try to pry it up. Nothing worked. So that evening he went up to see John Lee and said, "How about if we make a new cornerstone box, put it under the Buddha image, open up the old one and move all the valuable sacred things from the old box into the new one?" So John Lee nodded his head yes, and that's what was done. So it wasn't just that John Fuang went ahead and tried what John Lee told him to do. It was he also tried to think up a solution on his own and present that. That's the ingenuity aspect of the practice. It's not that you say, "Well, I've got this problem," and you go to running to the teacher and say, "Okay, solve the problem for me." You want to try your own solutions first. That way you become your own teacher, you become your own explorer of the Dharma. And you develop sensitivity as you do this. To what you're doing, you develop sensitivity to the results of what you're doing. And as the Buddha said, you use your actions like this as a mirror to watch your mind. That's how you purify the mind, that's how you purify the heart. So these are good basic principles to keep in mind as you practice. So that you can find that happiness that you want, the happiness that won't let you down.